The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Vision News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the NCRS, our holiday schedule coming up this month, from WLOS.com, Cards Benefit Sea Camps, TheRegReview.org, Debunking Myths, DisabilityRightsNC.org, Out-of-State PRTFs, ActionFund.org, Braille Readers Are Leaders. From Cornell University, new tool predicts where coronavirus binds to proteins. So let's get started. From the North Carolina Reading Service, Happy Holidays! The joy of brightening other lives becomes for us the magic of the holidays, quote by W.C. Jones. Holiday message from NCRS Executive Director. The holiday season will be here before we know it. Yes, it is. It is a time of joyful celebration, yet also a time of reflection. As we prepare to embrace our loved ones for the holidays, let us also take time to reflect with gratitude the blessings that we all are thankful for, and to think of our listeners during this time. You are the reason we exist. As we move forward to 2022, I'd like to sincerely pause a moment to express my utmost appreciation for each volunteer for your generosity and dedication to the North Carolina Reading Service. NCRS is extremely fortunate to have wonderful and committed volunteers throughout the year, and we do our best because of you. On behalf of our profoundly grateful listeners, NCRS Board of Directors, and staff, I wish you and your family good health, peace, and joy in 2022, and please continue to stay safe. Read on, May Tran. Save the date, New Visions Gala. We're spreading the news of a brighter future. After a two-year absence, the New Visions Gala is back. Please mark your calendars and join us on Friday, April 29th, 2022, for our New Visions Gala, We're Spreading the News for a Brighter Future. This fun-filled event will take place at the Hilton Raleigh North Hills. More information coming soon. Did you miss the Vision Aware webinar? Thank you to everyone who joined us for our webinar, Vision Aware, Sight Issues We Face as We Mature. If you missed this educational webinar, you can view the recording by clicking on a hot link. A special thank you to our sponsors and featured speaker, Omar Mohiuddin, M-O-H-I-U-D-D-I-N, Master of Science, OTR/L, MPH, for all his assistance for this informative webinar. The holiday hours will be closed on Friday, December 24th, Saturday, December 25th, and Friday, December 31st, 2021. We will also be closed on Saturday, January 1st, 2022. We wish you and your family a safe and happy holiday. Thank you. NCRS would like to thank everyone who recently donated to our latest appeal letter. It is not too late to make a contribution. No amount is too small. NCRS Board of Directors, Greg Suggs, President, Iris Green, Vice President, Sharon Benton, Secretary, Jeffrey Johnson, Treasurer, Joe Austin, Jim Cronin, Marcy Gordon, Brandon Hare, Craig Hayward, Bryce Smith, Cynthia Spate, Jennifer Walker, Past President, George Douglas, Co-Founders, Ben Eason, deceased, Dr. Ed Funkhauser. Contact NCRS staff, May Tran, Executive Director, may@ncreadingservice.org, Missy Hollander, Production Volunteer Manager, missy@ncreadingservice.org, Janet Schanzenbach, Director of Development and Community Relations, janet@ncreadingservice.org. From WLOS.com, Weaverville Girls Special Holiday Cards Benefit Camps for the Blind, Dateline, Weaverville, NC. Sometimes a holiday card is worth far more than meets the eye. 8-year-old Tempe Meinch, M-E-I-N-C-H, of Weaverville adds a personal touch that will touch hearts. Happy holidays, she says. Brailing special holiday cards that have more than just sentimental value, the cards made by blind and visually impaired children across the state benefit IFB Solutions SEE programs. SEE stands for Student Enrichment Experience, and these experiences have given Tempe, T-E-M-P-I, confidence, and independence for the past 6 years. As people purchase these cards, just know that they're helping children be able to have experiences in life, says Tempe's mother, Jessica. Things that I've done is like bowling. These are the things that I really love, said Tempe. Well, sea camp is really fun, and we get ice cream and go zip lining, which is really fun. She was born totally blind. Around 6 months, she started getting light perception, and she was diagnosed with optic nerve hypoplasia, explained Jessica. Despite Tempe's tiny optic nerve, she gained some vision in her left eye. The girl can now read and write, see shapes and colors, and even her favorite stuffed monkey. This bow is pink. These ears are red, Tempe said, describing her toy, and I see that her nose is like a straight line. She gets around really well, but technically she is still vision impaired, Jessica told News 13. She can see the colors. It's really amazing. She can see a lot. With every push of her Brailler's buttons, she wants to help others have the same camp experiences and the fun that creates lasting memories. From theregreview.org, Debunking Disability Enforcement Myths by Jasmine Harris and Karen Tani, T-A-N-I. Earlier this year, the New York Times Magazine profiled Albert Ditch, D-Y-T-C-H, the man who filed more than 180 disability lawsuits. The article's headline posed this question: is it profiteering or justice? The article went on to provide a relatively nuanced portrait of Ditch, a 71-year-old Californian with muscular dystrophy, but the headline exemplifies a problematic frame. It also offers a sharp reminder that even at a moment when disability-based discrimination features prominently in the news, misunderstandings abound about how lawmakers and administrators have tackled this discrimination, namely, incrementally, imperfectly, and with heavy reliance on the labor of disabled people themselves. We attempt here to identify and correct three of the most troubling myths about this area of law and regulation. Myth 1. To file a disability lawsuit against a place of public accommodation is to somehow take advantage of the system. U.S. lawmakers designed many modern civil rights laws to rely substantially on private enforcement through individual lawsuits. Agencies such as the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights play an important role in identifying and correcting civil rights violations. But the U.S. Congress also imagined that aggrieved individuals would go to court directly with their discrimination claims. Indeed, as political scientist Sean Farhang, F-A-R-H-A-N-G, has demonstrated, lawmakers from both political parties have had reasons to welcome private enforcement as they designed now landmark civil rights laws. For instance, for politicians who had concerns about intrusive centralized bureaucracy, private enforcement offered the possibility of a leaner federal administrative state. For politicians who wanted to make sure civil rights enforcement was not overly dependent on future congressional appropriations or the whims of administrators, private lawsuits offered the prospect of autopilot enforcement. The Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, explicitly encourages private enforcement, albeit not to the degree that advocates of accessibility might prefer. Title III of the Act, dealing with the public accommodations, authorizes affected parties to sue for injunctive relief. It gives prevailing parties the right to recover attorney's fees, and it does not require that prospective plaintiffs first exhaust potential administrative remedies before filing claims in court. In practice, courts have not been well disposed to Title III plaintiffs, as scholars such as Ruth Kolker and Samuel Bagenstos have demonstrated. Kolker is spelled C-O-L-K-E-R. Bagenstos is B-A-G-E-N-S-T-O-S. But there is no doubt that lawmakers contemplated such lawsuits, just as lawmakers contemplated private lawsuits to enforce the public accommodations title of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the Fair Housing Act. Notwithstanding the evidence of congressional intent and notwithstanding decades of evidence that the ADA is significantly under-enforced, popular narratives cast ADA litigation as inherently suspect. This fear of the disability con, as Doran Dorfman, D-O-R-F-M-A-N, has framed the broader phenomenon, taints litigation about public accommodations, It also creates unstable ground for the goal of building an accessible world, as Dorfman and Mariella Yabo, Y-A-B-O, have observed. Myth 2. The Americans with Disabilities Act is a source of predatory, serial litigation. It creates financial incentives for lawyers to recruit disabled plaintiffs with little to no connection with the program, service, benefit, or place of public accommodation targeted. The fact that private actors continue to bring lawsuits challenging the accessibility of places of public accommodations shows that the ADA is doing what it's supposed to do. To the extent plaintiffs are winning monetary damages or securing large settlements, however, this does not flow from the text of the ADA. Congress designed the ADA's enforcement structure to deputize private citizens, but Congress did not allow for the award of monetary damages to individual Title III plaintiffs, as the popular myth portrays. The monetary damages that Title III does allow are restricted to pattern and practice lawsuits that the Attorney General might file to address issues of public importance. Congress has also limited these damages to a maximum of $50,000 for a first violation and $100,000 for subsequent violations. Punitive damages are prohibited. Three additional aspects of Congress's enforcement scheme bear noting. First, the ADA moved through congressional committees at the same time as proposed legislation to limit broader civil rights procedural rights and remedies, and on the heels of large-scale state tort reform movements. Narratives of litigation abuse were rampant in the national media and gaining steam in Washington, D.C., from the K Street lobby firms to the halls on Capitol Hill. In 1986, U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican Kentucky, cast the American public as a deranged lover trapped in a mad romance with the civil litigation process. Meanwhile, newspapers showcased public disdain for plaintiffs whose greed has turned the temple of justice, long a hallowed place, into a pigsty. They called upon lawmakers to clean it up. The influence of this rhetoric is apparent from Congress's decision to limit plaintiffs' remedies under Title III. In general, compromise was a main theme of the ADA's legislative history, and a very fragile compromise was at the heart of Title III. Some state laws, however, allow plaintiffs to recover damages for enforcing the state equivalent of Title III provisions. This framework opens the door for plaintiffs to allege claims of discrimination under both state and federal law, and if successful, to receive monetary compensation under state law. Florida law, for example, allows plaintiffs to recover compensatory and punitive damages up to $100,000. Florida also makes it a second-degree misdemeanor to interfere with disabled individuals' access to places of public accommodation, punishable by a maximum fine of $500 or up to 60 days imprisonment. Second, it is misleading to suggest that under the ADA, individuals with no connection to particular places of public accommodation may sue owners or operators of those places to enforce the law. Challenges to plaintiffs' ability to sue often arise in Title III cases. Courts have generally found that plaintiffs must have some connection to the place of public accommodation to defeat such challenges, although courts' exact phrasing varies. For example, in the Fifth Circuit, courts may require more than mere speculation about a plaintiff's intent to access or return to a place of public accommodation, whereas in the Ninth Circuit, courts have permitted plaintiffs to bring test cases under Title III to challenge inaccessible hotels. Third, although lawyers may recover attorneys' fees under Title III of the ADA, they are only entitled to do so in cases where a plaintiff is the prevailing party. This concept may seem sufficiently broad to allow most plaintiffs' lawyers recovery of fees, but it certainly does not have that valence after the Supreme Court's decision in Buchanan Board and Home Care versus West Virginia Department of Health and Human Services. In that decision, the court rejected the long-standing catalyst theory and narrowed recovery to only specific contexts where a judicial order produces the change sought by a plaintiff. The requirement of a judicial imprimatur established in Buchanan reduces plaintiffs' leverage in settlement negotiations and also weakens lawyers' incentives to take on time-intensive and costly public interest litigation. Thus, the notion of an unbridled windfall for plaintiffs or their lawyers overstates the actual law. Together, these three contextual points make clear that serial plaintiffs and drive-by lawsuits are, in some sense, outgrowths of the law, but not in the ways that many public commentary suggest. Public distaste for disability discrimination plaintiffs and their lawsuits appears to be tied to societal misunderstandings about the ADA, disability law, and the nuances of disability as a sociopolitical identity. Myth 3. Legal reform efforts must focus on stopping, or at a minimum delaying, disability lawsuits. They cost too much and force small business owners, particularly those in minority communities, out of business. In January 2017, former U.S. Representative Ted Poe, Representative Republican, Texas, introduced H.R. 620, titled the ADA Education and Reform Act, in direct response to public narratives of serial ADA litigation. Notably, Poe framed his bill as a necessary compromise that would balance the interests of business owners against the interests of the disability lawsuit beneficiaries by affording business owners greater notice of alleged violations of Title III. It would impose additional procedural requirements on plaintiffs seeking to sue under Title III, such as providing written notice to owners with specific alleged violations and at least 60 days to cure them. It also would call for investment in alternative dispute resolution options. The bill passed the House by a vote of 225 to 192 in February 2018, but has remained dormant since. Importantly, H.R. 620 was not the first time Congress showed interest in amending Title III of the ADA to place additional notice requirements on plaintiffs. Since 2000, Congress has heard testimony on several ADA reform and notification bills, all of which laid the groundwork for H.R. 620. It is far from clear, however, that eliminating or postponing Title III enforcement actions is an appropriate solution to the problems that Representative Poe and others have perceived. Indeed, private business owners and operators have arguably been on notice of their obligations under the law for 31 years. In addition, studies suggest that accessibility violations persist and are hardly obscure. To the extent that predatory lawsuits remain concerning, there are other avenues to pursue. One straightforward solution is to use procedural and professional responsibility rules to address any unethical actions by lawyers filing frivolous lawsuits. For example, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure contain rules that require attorneys to attest to the non-frivolous nature of the lawsuit filed, or face potential sanctions enumerated in Rule 11, Subsection C. These sanctions include monetary fines or payment of reasonable attorney's fees and other expenses related to the violation. Although a court may act in response to a Rule 11 motion from a party, it may also do so on its own accord, with the goal to deter repetition of the conduct or comparable conduct by others similarly situated. Aggrieved parties can also file disciplinary actions with state bar licensing authorities. Specific governing rules of ethics may vary by state, but most states have rules that prohibit lawyers from filing frivolous lawsuits. If the perceived problem is less about the behavior of individual lawyers and more about systemic unfairness, again, there are a range of options that may be better than a bill like H.R. 620. For example, if the provision of compensatory and punitive damages is the source of public discontent, the most obvious route to change is the state-level political process. State legislators that currently encourage disability lawsuits could alter their laws. If the issue is instead the cost of accessibility or regulated parties' lack of understanding of their obligations, the best solution may be for the government to give more affirmative support rather than to weaken Title III's enforcement scheme. Such affirmative support could come in the form of additional tax subsidies for accommodations, more robust guidance, or greater investment in education campaigns. At a minimum, critics should note the perils of seeking to scale back private enforcement without also taking measures to enhance enforcement overall. 15 years ago, Sam Bagenstos showed how the imposition of limitations on civil rights remedies did not simply decrease the number of cases brought. It also affected the character of the cases filed in a way that suggested a dangerous, self-perpetuating loop. As he noted, concern with abusive litigation motivates the adoption of limitations on remedies. Those limitations lead plaintiffs' lawyers to engage in litigation conduct that appears even more abusive. The newly energized perception of abuse motivates adoption of even more limitations, and so on. What does it mean to file a disability-based anti-discrimination lawsuit, or even a series of such lawsuits in the United States today? Is it profiteering or justice? The New York Times would have us ask. Is it either profiteering or justice? And why are these two frameworks our only choices? The term profiteering connotes not only greed, but also a sort of hard-hearted exploitation, as if the Albert Ditches of the world are withholding some scarce commodity from people in need and parting with it only at an egregiously high price. But the disabled plaintiffs are the ones who lack what lawmakers have said they deserve, and to the extent they are demanding a price, it is a price that the government has set, and that the government has the power to change or to charge to different actors. Yes, litigants like Ditch and the lawyers representing them may benefit financially from the suits they file, but so too do litigants who sue to enforce fair housing laws or the False Claims Act. Why does the profiteering label seem to land in one category of litigants but not others? As for justice, private lawsuits are a vehicle for pursuing that noble goal, and one that democratically elected lawmakers have chosen. But few disability rights advocates would confuse these lawsuits with justice itself. Justice would require reckoning with why so many public venues and services remain inaccessible to significant segments of the population. It would also require reckoning with why our most prominent public narrators so often treat inclusion as a cost, leveled by the disabled few and charged to the morally innocent. Jasmine Harris is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Karen Tani is a Seaman Family University professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. This essay is part of a 5-part series titled Regulation and Disability Rights. Tags, Americans with Disabilities Act, Disability, Disability Adjudication, and Disability Rights. From actionfund.org, Braille readers are leaders. Attention, attention! For our 2021/2022 Braille Readers Are Leaders contest, we are making some big changes. With the input we received from you during our BRAL survey, we have decided to count minutes read instead of pages read, to encourage more folks to participate in the contest. Also, we will be using Beanstack for logging minutes. This year's contest began December 1, 2021, and will run through January 21, 2022. Administered by the American Action Fund for Blind Children and Adults in partnership with the National Federation of the Blind. General contest information. Purpose: to promote the joy of reading for pleasure, to promote a pride in Braille as a viable literacy medium equal to print, and to demonstrate the importance of independent reading in the development of Braille literacy skills. Eligibility: blind and low vision Braille reading students and adults. Registration. Registration for the 2021-2022 Braille Readers Are Leaders contest is open. You can recreate your account on Beanstack if you don't already have one, and register for the contest at http://actionfund.beanstack.org. The link to this video will help you get signed up using Beanstack on the web. That's a hot link. We are also producing a video for those who use screen readers, and we'll have it linked here shortly. You can also use Beanstack's Tracker app to register for the BRAL contest. Just download from either the iTunes or Google Play Store. You can register, log minutes, and see the leaderboard and more. As always, the American Action Fund does not want to exclude any interested contest participant who cannot use Beanstack or does not have access to the Internet. Please contact Braille Reading Contest at actionfund.org or call 410-659-9315 to discuss other reading log options. Summary of important dates. November 17th, that passed. Registration opened. Create your account and register for the contest. December 1st, also passed. The beginning of the contest and the first day participants can count their log minutes. January 21st, the end of the contest, the last day participants can track and add more minutes, and the last day to submit a registration form. January 28th, all minutes read during the contest period must be logged on Beanstack by 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. February 7th, winners will be announced and notified. Mid-February, prizes will be mailed out. breaking down the contest. Contestants compete against their same grade peers nationwide to read for the most minutes during the reading period. There are 5 grade categories and an adult category in the competition. Grades K-1, grades 2-3, grades 4-5, grades 6-8, middle school, and grades 9-12, high school, adults. Note, students classified as ungraded or those who have reading delays should register in the same category as their same age peers. For example, a 16-year-old student who reads at a third grade level should register in the high school category. However, he or she may read third grade materials. We have found that when students read material appropriate for their reading level, they are able to be competitive with their same age peers. Contestant T-shirt. All contest participants will receive a Braille Readers Are Leaders T-shirt. This shirt will be mailed as soon as possible after the participant registers for the contest and logs their first amount of minutes read. So if a participant reads for 20 minutes but on December 1st and logs his minutes into Beanstack that day, his T-shirt will be mailed to him as soon as December 2. If, however, participants wait until the end of the contest to register and log all of their minutes at once, that person will not receive a T-shirt or any other prizes they may have won until we send out all of the prizes in mid-February. In other words, register as soon as registration opens and start logging minutes right away, every day if possible. Prizes. This year, instead of a general prize pack, which is the same for all participants, prizes will be awarded based on number of minutes read. The more a participant reads, the more prizes they will earn. When participants log minutes each day as they read, they will receive emails with fun badges they have earned in recognition of their efforts. Participants will also be notified when the milestone they have reached also has a prize attached to it. Participants can also check out the contest leaderboard to see how their number of minutes stack up against their peers. We encourage participants to see how many minutes they can read throughout the contest period. Can you have a reading streak each day of the contest? What prizes and badges can you earn? The only way to find out is to register, read, and log your minutes. In addition to the prizes earned based on minutes read, the participant who read the most number of minutes in a particular grade category will win a cash prize. Rules for the contest. Contestants must meet the eligibility criteria. All reading materials must meet the criteria for acceptable materials. See below. All materials must be read between December 1 and January 21. Registration form must have the name and contact information of a parent, guardian, or teacher. Not meeting the required dates for registration or logging minutes will disqualify a contestant. All decisions of the judges are final. Parent, guardian, teacher. The parent, guardian, teacher is responsible for registering the student for the contest, assisting the student in finding suitable extracurricular Braille books and other materials to read for the contest, verifying the student read the Braille material listed and that the material was read between the beginning and ending dates of the contest, submitting the reading log in an accurate, complete, and timely fashion. I ran out of room for the rest of the rules. Please go to actionfund.org to read the rest of the requirements, and I won't get to my other 2 articles. So, we've run out of time for today's episode of Vision News. Be sure to listen next week. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Doris Hyde, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number, 919-832-5138.